Welcome to Stone Cold Stros. I'm Brandon Strange with Charlie Polillo and Josh Jordan. You can find them on X at Polillo and at Josh Jordan 975. And in between episodes of our show here, you can read their blogs on sportsmap.com. On today's episode, we're over a third of the way through spring training. We finally got to see, or more appropriately, hear about Altuve playing left. But is this the more of the overblown stories in spring? We'll dig into it. The rest of the outfield still looks like an uphill battle, but is there an answer in plain sight? Well, some of our viewers think so. And did the Astros let an opportunity pass them by with a reliever who just signed with another team? You be the judge. So as we teased in the open, Jose Altuve got reps in left field on Friday and Sunday. Not a single ball was hit him on Friday, but Sunday we got to see a glimpse of Altuve's erratic throwing in left as he committed an error after a defensive misplay by Luis Guillorme. Two innings later, he chased down a liner on the warning track to steal away a potential extra base hit. So my conspiratorial side believes that the Astros choosing to play him on non-televised games is not a coincidence. But the sample size in spring training points to a discussion that we haven't had yet on this channel about left field and how the left fielders really only get 1 to 3 opportunities defensively per game to make plays. Charlie, when we brought this up pre-show, you actually had some sample data by putouts by position that you can get into if you want to. But Charlie, we start with you. It begs the question, is Jose Altuve's move to left field really much ado about nothing?
I won't say much ado about nothing because second base is a very important defensive position. But on the spectrum of defense, yeah, left field is a big slugger type position, right? Historically, left field and first base until that designated hitter thing came along in the early 70s. Look at Yordan Alvarez. The Astros didn't think he took well to playing first base when they gave him a brief look at that in spring training a few years ago. So, all right, where can we have that bat in the lineup if someone else is DHing? You put him in left field, especially the left field of cozy, now Daikin Park. But the left fielder who makes the most catches is going to average about 2 putouts per game. It's just not a super high volume defensive position. It's the pull field for many more hitters than not. You know, roughly 2/3 of batters are right-handed hitters. So if they're driving one to left field, there's a good chance the left fielder's watching it go over them off the wall or into the seats. But it's not as if it's a trivial defensive position. And while we could talk about putouts, right, chances are just putouts and assists. But if you're the left fielder with the noodle arm, who turns singles into doubles, or who has runners go from first base to third base on you at will, or score on a single to relatively short left field that they'd be getting the stop sign from the third base coach with other guys out in the outfield defensively. Those don't count as outfield chances, but are plays where weakness can impact defensively. Right? Barry Bonds won a whole bunch of gold gloves in left field, but he was in left field because he didn't have a great arm for a center fielder. And Barry's offense was the signature, right? Except for elite, elite up the middle defenders, the offensive component is more important than the defensive component. So for Jose Altuve, that'll be true in left field as it was at second base, but they just felt he had deteriorated so badly at second base that they're better off with Altuve in left and whoever winds up playing second base as opposed to whoever in left field with Altuve at second base.
It's funny you brought up the guys taking second base, Charlie, because it occurred to me, I'm kind of tongue-in-cheek here, but the Astros were pretty terrible. It felt like holding guys on first base to where anybody with any kind of speed could take second almost at will. So the type of hitter that would try and take second base on a weak arm guy might be the exact same guy that would steal second base on the next pitch or two. So just kind of keep that in mind. The Astros really struggled. And we know what the rule changes, the bigger bases, how many times you can throw over there. If a guy's got any kind of speed at all, they can take second base pretty easily these days. So I wonder if that's part of it. And now it makes so much sense with the Astros thinking about this. If they are that analytical team that we've always thought them to be, if Altuve's only getting a handful of chances a game in left field, then it feels kind of like a low-risk move compared to how much action he'll get at second base, especially with Hunter Brown and Fromber on the mound. The other thing I thought was Espada's comments, they actually came out on Monday that He said, I would like to leave Altuve at one position for the majority of games. The back and forth is something that I'm going to try and avoid. I think if we commit to him in left field, and as we sit right here, that's kind of where they're at. He thinks he'll get more starts there unless something changes. He did mention he would get some reps at second base, that at different points in the season, maybe they want to get Yordan out in left field, use the DH for somebody else. They play Altuve there at those games. But as far as moving him back and forth from day to day, second base, left field, that doesn't look like that's going to be the plan. For the most part, if things continue and Altuve is comfortable, you're going to see him in left field most days.
Yeah, and they should want Altuve in the DH role, off his feet entirely, about once per week, which would leave about 135 games. So if he's playing, say, 100 of those in left field, and then you have 35 at second base, where Yordan, 35 is well below the 53 that he played last year. They're clearly intending to slash his number of games in the outfield. But the Sunday game really distilled what probably will be the Altuve defensive experience to that first inning. He's going to have a very weak arm. And collectively, a primary outfield of Altuve, Myers, McCormick, going to be about as bad as it gets in Major League Baseball in terms of throwing the ball. But Altuve makes that nice catch going up against the wall. He's going to track fly balls, I think, very well. He still runs well, not the same speed that he had in his mid-20s, now that he's in his mid-30s. But going to get the ball, I think he'll be okay. But the height will be an issue at times. And, you know, in which moments... Right? You're not a high-volume defender in left field, but in which moments, if the tying run is on second in the top of the eighth inning or the bottom of the ninth inning or the go-ahead winning run and is a ground ball single through the hole, that left field is pretty important in those moments.
Continuing on the topic of outfield, the theme of the spring to this point has been those outfield concerns. Up until Sunday, Myers, McCormick, and Dubon were 0 for 23 at the plate. Myers was able to scratch across a couple of hits Sunday, but Chaz and Doobie still sitting on goose eggs. Gamble experiencing tightness in the back, so that's not a great sign early. DeZenzo is expected to get ample opportunities to carve out a place for himself on this team based on comments, so we'll see how that plays out for him. One of the consistent questions that we get on this channel since the beginning of spring is about Alex Verdugo. And since the news cycle is a little slow, this is probably as good a time as we'll have to answer that. So we start with you, Charlie. I want you to sell me on Verdugo because he's not even on my radar. Verdugo's best attributes to this point is that he plays a good left field. And we just talked about how defensively that can be a little overrated.
Yes, but he also can play a good right field. He was the Red Sox primary right fielder as recently as 2023, then moved to the Yankees. And with Judge and Soto, it was left field or no field for Alex Verdugo, who was a terrible player in 2024. So is he the guy, right? If you can sign him for $5 million and say that keeps you just underneath the first CBT threshold. But then if you need to make any in-season acquisitions or you have extra injuries that force you to use additional roster spots and pay guys, is Verdugo a guy that you want to nudge into the tax for? But the outfield, my God, he is a left-handed hitter. As awful as he was last season, for his career, he's been a solid platoon bat. El Succo versus lefties, over 775 career OPS versus righties. So he'd be a natural platoon with Chaz McCormick in right field. Chaz, for his career, save 2024, has clobbered lefties against righties, has been somewhere from okay to woeful. And Verdugo in a pinch could also play a little center field. So, you know, if it's merely $5 million as he waits and waits and waits, it's certainly justifiable. If DeZenzo was a left-handed hitter, I'd say the pathway's there for real playing time. But unless you're in not really a platoon, but a McCormick and Myers are so freaking terrible, give DeZenzo some of those at-bats, even though he's also a right-handed hitter. But a left-handed bat, Alex Verdugo absolutely has been a better major league player than Ben Gamel. Well, the Astros signed Ben Gamel because he only costs them $1.2 million if he makes the team. Verdugo's probably still going to be a $4 or $5 million player. And his one frame of reference, right, Jorge Polanco, who was no good for the Mariners, and they wind up re-signing him because they were too cheap to do anything else. Polanco got $7.75 million guaranteed for the Mariners for this season. He was a better player last season than Alex Verdugo. So if they're saying, hey, that's roughly our market, The Astros are not just being tightwaddy and saying, no, we're not paying that for Alex Verdugo.
Well, we saw reports that Dana Brown checked in on Verdugo several weeks ago. And I think it's the same deal with him, with all the teams in baseball. He thinks he's worth a little bit more money than MLB teams are willing to give him. And now we're getting really close here. Like you mentioned, Brandon, what, a third of the way through spring training, still nothing going on there. You wonder at what point will he drop his asking price a little bit. I remember when we did offseason predictions, like there were some places that had projections of him getting like 4 years, $60 million, some websites. And I was like, what are you talking about? Did you see how bad he was last year? But even on the low end, they're predicting, you know, $8-9 million a year, which I think would still be a little too rich for the Astros' blood. And they're trying to, you know, work in Altuve in left, so it doesn't look like he would play there. And then you're talking about center and right. And that's the other narrative we've heard. Do we want to, you know, move Jake out of center field? They feel so comfortable with him there. I don't know how the Astros would view Verdugo compared to Jake Meyers defensively. And then the other thing with Gamble, which is really hurting you, he hasn't gotten a hit all spring. He's like 0 for 5 and dealing with back soreness. So not only has he been performing poorly, Chaz hasn't been hitting. Like you mentioned, Jake only got a couple hits just the other day. So all in all, and throw Dubon in there. I know we're kind of considering him a second baseman at this point, but he's spent plenty of time in the outfield over the past couple seasons. He hasn't done anything either, I believe. Yeah, he's still hitless. So for all these guys that are kind of the come back and show us what you can do, Astro guys that we're hoping can have a bounce back year, it is looking bad. I know it's early in spring, but you have guys, you know, like Shea Wickham. He's already got a home run and has some hits. And DiZenzo's leading the team in hits. He's had a few opportunities. So I'm starting to wonder, are those guys going to be better options? And they were basically what Sugarland, the best they had to offer last year. And here they are this year looking better in spring than a lot of these returning veterans for the Astros.
Guys like DiZenzo and Whitcomb, DiZenzo in particular, would give you a second converted infielder to outfielder. So Jake Meyers is going to play every day because it's all he can eat going to track down balls. But as so many of the Astros' issues somehow connect to the lameness of the current farm system, Jacob Melton already sent to minor league camp because he showed up with a sore back. You know, Ben Gamel's a journeyman who just hasn't done much in the major leagues, and he's 33 years old. Jacob Melton, supposed to be one of the Astros' top two or three prospects, he's 24 and almost 6 months old already, and he shows up with a sore back, doesn't even get any spring training action, and now go play on the backfields and take live batting practice for a couple days, and then maybe you can rejoin the club later in the week. But obviously a zero factor to try to make the club out of spring training, and he's the left-handed hitting athletic outfielder who would fit naturally, taking playing time from Meyers and or McCormick, but just doesn't seem to be in play. But the Astros will probably hold out enough hope on Jacob Melton, you know, as one of their best prospects, who would play for the major league minimum, as opposed to Alex Verdugo. And if you sign him, his money's guaranteed for the season. But Verdugo, you know, for those who've, if not clamoring for him, at least been tapping on the door, right? He was a young, looked like possible star when he came up with the Dodgers. He peaked early. His two best seasons in the big leagues were when he was 23, 24 years old. But he was one of the key principals in the Mookie Betts trade with the Red Sox. The three seasons before 2024, he was really a very mediocre player. But mediocre is better than stinking like rotten eggs. Meyers, McCormick, 2024 offense. But the Astros are not going to $7, $8 million on Alex Verdugo. And defensively so, even though you can counter that with saying, but look at what you have.
Just a quick message. If you're interested in advertising your service or product on this show, you can contact our friends on the sales team at houston.sportsmap.com/advertise. The link is in the description as well. Let's move over to the pitching updates. Lance McCullers has taken the next step in his journey from injury. He has now faced live batters on the backfield in Palm Beach. Only 20 pitches, but hitting 94.7 on the gun. But this is a process, but it's at least progressing in the right direction. Forrest Whitley has looked good so far in spring. Hader has already surrendered a long ball. Again, too small of a sample size to overreact to. Former Astros right-hander, I thought this was interesting, Seth Martinez was claimed off waivers by the Mariners. I think we counted this as his third team this spring. On the topic of former Astros relievers, one thing that we were discussing before we got started here was Hector Neris getting a minor league deal from the Braves. Not saying that Neris would be anything close to a transformative signing for this team, but considering the questions that they have about bullpen depth with the loss of Presley. Do you find it a little strange that Houston wasn't the team to make that deal, given Hector's history with the Astros?
A little bit. Now, part of it makes sense that they didn't want to do that because, you know, the Cubs got rid of him mostly because of salary last year, but also he wasn't that great for them. He had a 3.89 ERA, not terrible, but they paid him a lot of money. And then, but you look when he came over to the Astros, 4.7 ERA. So even in that smaller amount of time with Houston, Neris was actually worse with the Astros, even getting back with his pitching coaches. He's going to be 36 years old this season. So he's getting up there, but we talked about this last week. Espada's like, hey, I want to take some innings off Hader this year. I want to take some innings off Abreu this year. So to me, that just seems kind of like a low risk. We'll give it a shot there with Neris. And, you know, it's a minor league deal. See what he does. So that does surprise me a little bit that they didn't kick the tires on him. But at the same time, they had him in-house at the end of last season. So maybe their analytics department, their scouting eyes, being around it, maybe they saw something that we don't know, maybe something that the Braves don't know. So I'll give the Astros the benefit of the doubt there, but considering their need, and Forrest Whitley, I know as great as he's been looking, you can't say anything about his track record makes you think, you know, oh, we have to count on him to be the seventh inning guy. Taylor Scott, that was kind of his first year of being good in a role like that. You know, King is a guy where we hope he can do it again, but who knows? Bennett Sousa, he's kind of gotten lit up in his early appearances this spring. So it's not like the Astros have a ton of other guys where you're like, oh no, there's no way we have room for Hector Neris. So we'll see. We'll see how it goes with the Braves. But I just thought it was interesting. It's Dana Brown doesn't have a lot of money to play with. And this would have been an opportunity to give somebody a chance without having to go over the tax threshold.
Couple points. Neris was not good last season as the Cubs and after he came back with the Astros. Gave up 4 home runs in the 15 innings that he worked here. 35 years old, maybe just hit a career wall. And when you are counting the beans, being mindful of where you are for the tax threshold, in-season moves potential, you know, you sign Neris that if he makes the team, he makes $1.5 million or $2 million. Well, Caleb Ort, Brian King, Forrest Whitley, Taylor Scott, none of those guys will make more than $800,000. And you'd have a 40-man roster position you need to open if you were to sign Hector Neris. So over the difference of $500,000 to $1 million, coupled with his 2024 performance, it's a reasonable pass for them.
Charlie, before we're out the door here, we are a third of the way through spring. What are you looking for specifically from guys, or any final thoughts that you have in these this last two-thirds, guys you'll have your eyes on that could really make a difference on this team?
Well, not that Joe Espada needs to carve it into the tablet just yet, but he appears to have settled on the top of the lineup structure that we talked about a week or two ago. Altuve, followed by Isak Paredes, who does profile as a pretty solid on-base percentage guy. Yordan in a 3 spot with Christian Walker cleanup, which would mean Yiner Diaz 5, and then 6 through 9 probably paying you down. You just cross your fingers a lot and hope something sorts itself out. But if the Astros are going to be a really good team in 2025, the root cause is going to be the starting pitching. And everyone, of course, the first couple times through is going a couple innings, 3 innings max. But among Fromber and Hunter Brown and Ronel Blanco and Spencer Arrighetti and Hayden Wesneski, not a hiccup yet. Everyone's arm seems sound. Nobody's saying, reporting a little forearm tightness or anything like that. Because if the Astros 2025 starting pitching somehow implodes, the season's over. But if healthy, they have a rotation that probably runs with the top 3 or 4, certainly in the American League, and not too far more than that down the list in Major League Baseball.
The one thing, Hader, you mentioned Brandon, oh, a home run already. Yeah, 1 inning, 1 home run, Hader. And as we were talking about Hector Neris here, if Hader's not significantly better this year, this is going to be a huge problem, especially they're already trying to take innings off of Brian Abreu. So it's just concerning to me that it seems like he gives up the long ball so easily, especially for a guy that's paid like he is. And Buster Olney from ESPN put out his top 10 relievers in baseball like he does every season. His first year in a long time, Hader wasn't on there. He made honorable mention. But it just goes to show you that it's not just us Astros fans. People across baseball are noticing Hader's not quite what he used to be. But if we're thinking positive, maybe it's that every other year thing. We've talked about it on the podcast. Maybe he'll bounce back and have a better season. but I'm starting to get a little bit concerned. It's just, there's so much hard contact that he gives up. So, and just being able to spot that fastball too, that's a big thing for him. That's what killed him, was just throwing it right down the middle, fastball after fastball. I mean, these are big league hitters, man. They can time a bullet. If you keep throwing fastballs down the middle, I don't care if he, and he's not throwing 99 regularly anymore, but even if he was, guys can start to time that stuff up. So he'll be something I'm paying attention to. And then end on the positive. So far, so good as far as the Kyle Tucker trade. Wes Neske, we're liking what we're seeing out of him. Paredes getting on base, hitting home runs. That's looking good. Cam Smith, the talk of spring training. He leads your team in home runs this spring with two of them. How awesome is that? And then I know he wasn't part of the Kyle Tucker trade, but Christian Walker, he was brought in as a piece to add a bat because you were losing Bregman and you were losing Tucker. So all those additions so far looking really good for Dana Brown and the Astros.
Yeah, I like it. And going back to Hader, $95 million was already a sporty contract, but $95 million for every other year. Good work if you can get it. One last reminder, if you're watching on YouTube, be sure to click like on the video. And if you listen on podcasts on apps like Apple or Spotify, please consider giving us a 5-star rating. Let us know in the comments who or what you'll be watching for in this last 2/3 of the spring season. Our next episode will drop on Thursday. Make sure you're subscribed to this channel, Sports Map Houston, and our other channel, Sports Map Texans. We drop bonus episodes as news breaks. Thanks for listening. For Charlie and Josh, I'm Brandon. And saying so long, and until next time, go Astros.
And that's the bottom line, because Stone Cold said so.